Hello. What are you even looking at? Put your fucking phone away.
Drage poslušalke, pozdravljene v 15. epizodi Povratnih zank, mesečni oddaji o internetni kulturi, teoriji in literaturi. Današnji input je posvečen alternativnim zgodovinam in pogledom na razvoj in vlogo umetne inteligence v kontekstu sodobnega planetarnega tehnološkega režima. O nezahodnocentrični teoretizaciji strojne inteligence bomo govorile z urednicama dela Machine Decision is not final, China and the History and Future of Artificial Intelligence, Amy Ireland in Bogno Konjor.
Put your fucking phone away.
Zbornik Machine Decision is not final, China and the History and Future of Artificial Intelligence je izšel konec lanskega leta v sodelovanju založbe Urbanomic, fakultete NYU Shanghai in raziskovalnega centra Center for Artificial Intelligence and Culture. Urednice Anna Greenspan, Amy Ireland, Bogna Konjor in Benjamin Breton so v delu zbrale prispevke, ki kritično obravnavajo zahodne konceptualizacije strojnega učenja, razvoja tehnologije in planetarne komputacije. Pod vprašanje postavljajo tako odzive, ki v umetni inteligenci vidijo tehnološko singularnost, kot tiste, ki jo pojmujejo kot grožnjo človeški kogniciji. S kontekstualizacijo zgodovine misli o umetni inteligenci na Kitajskem, poglobljenimi razmisleki o naravi inteligence, planetarnosti in volje ter znanstveno fantastiko in fikcijo, nam zbornik poskuša naslikati kompleksen preplet različnih produktivnih teoretskih perspektiv, ki skupaj fenomen umetne inteligence zapopadajo z analitično natančnostjo in skrbjo, ki jo pogosto primankuje.
Would be the most important lesson about AI that we could learn through a non-Anglocentric lens? Is it pulling the focus away from human benchmarks as the measuring stick used to compare and dismiss AI, but rather embracing them, casting human exceptionalism aside? Or is it the deep and rich history of transdisciplinary research that gave rise to modern conceptualizations of AI?
So our impulse in making this book, I remember from our initial discussion, was to create a volume that, first of all, would include various disciplines. So we have science fiction writers, we have anthropologists, historians, and to really focus on the part of conversation about China and AI and the future and history that's not really represented, maybe, in the mainstream discussion about these subjects. If you walk into a bookstore and go to China and tech section, you will find, you know, menacing looking books with some kind of scary red eye on the cover. And they're very frequently about Chinese politics and state politics and technology filtered through, you know, Western perspective and contrast with liberal democracy and so on. So not to dismiss these works, but we wanted to make something different and focus on both how to think about AI from the perspective of, for example, Chinese philosophy or the long tradition of thinking about machines and human agency and the question of nature and artifice in Chinese philosophy. We also wanted to highlight the glitches and complications that are happening in contemporary Chinese digital culture to kind of go against this idea that it's all this smooth authoritarian governance that's defining how this technology is being engaged in China. So that was part of the motivation. And we also wanted to make a book that would be interesting to people who are interested in AI. Because very often when you make a book about China and technology, or I don't know, Slovenia and technology, or Poland and technology, only people who have an interest in that specific region of the world are expected to actually reach for it, which preserves certain hierarchies, and you know, I hate that. So we wanted to really create a book that is not just appealing to people in area studies, but that will stand on its own as an inquiry into the question of artificial intelligence. And that's why a lot of the sections in the book are quite conceptual. They're not just historical or ethnographic. We want them to endure, even as we do paint the landscape of what's happening in China right now. We want them to be relevant beyond the current moment. And finally, I also want to add that we have a specific perspective, and that's also why we went to Urbanomic to produce this book. And also that's reflected in our title, which is to think about the intersection of human agency and technology and kind of deep futures and transformations that are happening around the question of humanism and what's happening to it when it comes to AI and these bigger historical transformations that's probably missing from a lot of mainstream books about China that do not take this type of philosophical perspective. I have more to say, but I will also leave some space for Amy to answer that.
Maybe you can come back in afterwards, because I'm interested in what you're going to say about it. So I think basically one of the things that Bogner's pointing out is that in an effort to not continue to confine China to this position of the other, or as some kind of foil to Western ideas of AI, that the book is really about a kind of complexity or a complexification of that discourse. But I want to point to particular little nutshell things that I think are really interesting takeaways, if you take away nothing else, as a Westerner or a non-Chinese person looking at the history of China and AI. And the first one is brought up in Shuang Frost's essay, which is called Translating Chinese AI from Human-Made Intelligence to Black Tech. And her first point in that is that the Chinese, just the Chinese term for AI, Yangong Zheneng, doesn't include the word artificial. It transliterates roughly as human-made wisdom ability. And the word for Yangong has also a kind of connotation of manual labor in it. So it positions AI as an extension of human powers and capacities, not as a rival to it, and specifically not as an individuated rival to it. It's completely free of all of the baggage that in a lot of European languages, including especially English, that is carried by the word artificial. So all of these ideas of like falsity, deception, something's not natural, like all of that is just not present. And that kind of positions the discourse in China around AI to unfold very differently, just that set of associations being absent. And in relation to that first point about intelligence being sort of an extension of the human, there's a whole section of the book dedicated to texts dealing with the Chinese cybernetician Chen Xuesen, who's a really interesting figure. And I think there's a few books out there written by non-Chinese authors that deal with his work, but not very many. And a lot of it's not really translated outside of Chinese. I think it's starting to happen now. But there's a couple of like really brilliant essays in there that explain some of the intricacies of his thinking. But the main takeaway from Chen Xuesen's work is that in the West, we kind of have a tendency to think of AI we think of intelligence as a subject. And the model for intelligence is like an individual human subject. And we've sort of had this in place. I mean, it can be complexified and challenged, but we've sort of had this in place since the Turing test. So we kind of have this setup which positions us to see an individuated intelligence as somehow in competition with us as individuated intelligences, as the kind of, you know, mainstream view of what human intelligence is. Whereas Chen Xuesen's work was very much about thinking of intelligence as a system. So intelligence is not something that you can talk about in terms of an individual. It's always an individual in relationship with other things. And these things in the system are always kind of heterogeneous as well. It's not just other humans. It's humans and machines and rule sets and raw material. So this kind of systems thinking, because of Qian Shuaisen's huge influence, is really embedded in that discourse around AI in China. And this, again, just kind of like sidesteps all of this. I don't want to kind of emphasize it too much because there is anxiety in China around AI, but it sidesteps a lot of this like eschatological type thinking of AI is going to replace us. There's going to be like an AI singularity and humanity is going to be destroyed. It sets everything up to be just much more pragmatic and muted and downplayed, for better or worse. And I just want to say on Qian Shuaisen, like, as well as that kind of stuff, he's kind of a really interesting guy because he also had a lot of like unorthodox thoughts about intelligence. And even though this part of his history is kind of suppressed in China, he spent a long time kind of exploring the fusion of Qigong with cybernetics, which in practical terms for him kind of meant exploring the extrasensory capacities of people, of humans, in a cybernetic system with computers to build a kind of like unprecedented computer that had some sort of like supernatural powers. So as well as being like a hardcore cybernetician who was like involved in China's nuclear weapons program and a lot of early computers and computer theory, he also kind of was like way out there on this edge, talking about supernatural powers. So yeah, really, really interesting guy.
So yeah, there's some peculiarities about the Chinese approach, let's call it, to AI, which are interesting, which is, for example, that when you poll people about AI fears, in general, people score much lower on fear of artificial intelligence taking over than their Western counterparts. So there seems to be some cultural element, right, that could explain that. And I think what Amy is describing might be part of that. We also see in Vincent Garton's chapter, which is one of my favorite ones, where he reinterprets the ancient Chinese text Han Feizi. It's a text about governance, and he kind of uses it as a way to talk about automation and automation without the state, but also very much arguing against certain ideas in Western political philosophy that are found in the Leviathan, that are exactly about, you know, what Amy was also describing, these theological, eschatological kind of individuations of intelligence and power that maybe are not so inherent to something like ancient Chinese philosophy, as Vincent is describing. So yeah, of course, we don't want to essentialize too much that there's something like one Chinese approach to what AI is. And I personally find it a bit unconvincing, these arguments that, oh, in Buddhism, anything can be part of the bigger family of beings and therefore AI also. These are not very convincing, but we do try in the book to kind of show different, I guess, points of entry into this question of China and AI.
Many contributions or articles or essays that constitute the work often return to thinking about AI as infrastructure, specifically tying it into broader questions about cosmotechnics, encoded metaphysical commitments, and statecraft. How do you think these reflections square up against, for example, the American model of building AI centers as speculative finance instruments? Is this like a genuine divergence in technical paradigms, or simply two financialized expressions of the same planetary system?
So there is one scholar we cite in the introduction who says that to think about the genealogy of AI in China, you have to look at that legalism and bureaucracy place within Chinese philosophy of governance, and that these traditions are extremely important. For example, when you travel to Suzhou, which is close to Shanghai, and that has beautiful scholarly gardens that the Chinese aristocracy and scholars used to hang out in, the garden names are the humble administrator, for example. So administration and bureaucracy is something that's held in great reverence, and there's respect for that in Chinese culture. So in the introduction, you know, one of the angles we are exploring is that this is an element of thinking about AI in China. And especially from where we were when we were writing the introduction, At that time, China did not seem that interested in LLMs or generative AI, while this was really all the hype in the West, and much more interested in thinking about agriculture, for example, where we saw a lot of implementation of automation, kind of in line with previous experiments in China with integrating, you know, Alibaba everywhere, and like every farmer being able to connect to the great machine of trade within these new infrastructures and so on. So I think, you know, by the virtue of the fact that Chinese internet ecosystem is kind of its own vibrant but enclosed ecology, and that it is this huge infrastructure of services and technologies and connections, it does make sense that AI would be built into this as an additional layer, and that they are figuring a way out to embed it into this structure. So it's not as much separated, I guess, from it, as we can see the financial markets in the sphere of abstraction and like capital production, maybe in the West. I wouldn't, you know, make very definitive claims, but that's just my thoughts right now about your questions.
It's also something that Bingcheng Meng talks about in her piece, Guizhou on the Cloud, where she does a sort of like, I think it's sort of like a field work case study of this government project to basically make like the whole of this quite disenfranchised province, like a basically cloud computational hub. And she kind of like looks a little bit at the discrepancy between the official discourse around what's happening and how it all looks on the ground. But just this idea of AI as being like this practical thing that you deploy as part of a government system, with this rhetoric built in that it's going to improve people's lives, access to power, information, energy in an area of China that's like really quite disenfranchised and remote. I guess there's also this kind of like big divide between like rural areas and metropolitan centers in China, that this is kind of this big data picture in Guizhou is kind of helping to smooth out a little bit. But there's also just like the idea of the smart city in China is huge, and like there are Bogna, maybe you know better where the sort of actually existing smart cities are, like Hangzhou maybe is smart city.
I'm not sure, but like I was thinking that there's definitely structures like, you know, all this green credit stuff where like through your phone you can plant a tree somewhere else in China and so on, which is part of the smart city and eco-city infrastructure too.
Yeah, so this is all kind of like also tied in with a lot of like ecological rhetoric. So there's, I think, maybe a broader sense of application of AI. It's much more immediate, pragmatic, and tied in with bureaucracy and administration than the sort of narrow profit-driven approach that you've kind of isolated as being the kind of driving vector of Western development of AI.
There's also flip side to that, right? So these like fantasies of smart cities and perfect management and frictionless governance, I think that's something also that we see challenged. For example, in Xia Jia's science fiction story, which is about a science fiction writer who lives through a COVID lockdown, which was kind of an embodiment and actualization of this fantasy of frictionless management with the help of artificial intelligence. And in the story, the writer becomes very disillusioned with this idea that AI can provide this, can really deliver this like perfect socialist or communist management, and disease will be defeated, and we're all engineering towards a glorious future, and so on. And obviously that's not what happened during COVID zero. It was quite frictionful. There were a lot of problems, and the problems were not just because of the authoritarian exercise of power, but also where the power broke down and things were not working and were failing all the time, and so on. So that's also important to kind of see that these infrastructural politics are not necessarily converging towards this sort of frictionless totality, but actually there's a lot of gaps and breakages. We also have a picture in the introduction that went viral during the COVID lockdown, and this was at the immigration center. And in Chinese, the notice simply said something about an error of the technical system and please wait until it is fixed. But the English translation that went viral on Chinese social media said, please wait patiently for the failure of the system. So people found that very kind of appropriate to their experience. And that's what's also fascinating, because yes, there is this very craftful, I guess, infrastructural politics that is happening in China, and definitely the level of technological embeddedness within these structures. If you see it from the United States, where people are complaining about lack of basic public services, is something that stands in big contrast. But on the other hand, when seen from the West as this fantasy of totalitarian like governance and control, that's not really the lived reality or what is happening with how the technology is actually when it's implemented.
Continuing straight from that, the theory of planetary computation suggests a unified technological paradigm that systemizes and shapes our world. Yet this volume or book exposes deep divergences in how technology is theorized. Does Planetary describe a shared material system beneath these differences, or does it risk flattening real epistemic and political asymmetries?
I think that, Bogner, correct me if I'm wrong, but I think the general approach of the book is to view both the local and sort of, I guess, like the cosmo-technical account of the evolution of technology and the universal, which they sort of understand as really being a Western paradigm, a Western particularity masquerading as a universal. Both of those accounts of artificial intelligence and the development of this technology are insufficient, which is to say you can't just rely on a kind of local account of specific cultures and histories create a specific model of, or a specific epistemic and political paradigm. But neither is there just one big universal system. And the kind of idea, I mean, I'm not sure how much this conflicts with prior theorizations of the planetary, but Bratton's way of talking about it in the afterword is at least to say that the planetary for him is a way of challenging the universal and challenging the particularist at the same time, by trying to put different ways of approaching this technology into dialogue and translating between them, which is kind of one of the reasons why the three editors from Shanghai NYU, Bogner, Anna and Ben, were kind of putting all of these voices into dialogue with one another. So you've got like, you've got Chinese theorists in China writing about Chinese AI, you've got Chinese theorists in the West, you've got Western theorists in China and Western theorists in the West. So it's like you're sort of seeing this problem from diverse angles, not just, which are kind of like undoing this polarity between the universal and the particular, ideally. So the kind of, I think the positioning is nominally that, and whether or not you see that as planetary or see that as challenging planetarity, the idea is to complexify that relationship between global local accounts and universal imaginaries.
I mean, we take care to deal with this question in the introduction and the afterword. I will try as best as I can to like repeat my own arguments from the introduction. But I think there is an obvious issue, I think, in trying to articulate or like escape this conversation actually of like Western and non-Western that can feel very quickly like a trap. And this is not just in the case of China, it's in the case of, you know, Eastern Europe, Latin America, Southeast Asia, wherever you are, you will be asked about this, okay, but is this Western or is it non-Western? And kind of the framing is forced onto you as a way to interpret yourself. Like, like, are you Western or are you non-Western in your claims? And I really love, this is an essay by Wang Xin. It was actually in Iflux. It's called Asian Futurism and the Non-Other. And she says, yes, the other has gained a voice, but only to constantly contextualize and explain itself. And that takes all the energy and time for actual thinking that we would like to do. So that's an obvious problem. And, you know, when you try to, for example, in China, point out something that's particular, you might be called, you're exoticizing. When you try to point out something that resonates globally, you'll be like, oh, you're like westernizing, and like this is just like Western colonial mindset that you're projecting right now. So this type of thinking can very often be running in circles, and it does preserve a sort of hierarchy, I think, still, about who is perceived as particular versus who is perceived as universal, which still is quite dominant, because we don't really have books that would be titled like recent British thought experiments about AI or like recent American thought about AI. It's just called AI ethics, right? And that's what it is essentially. But in the book, we're still forced to kind of do this, okay, China and the history and future of AI, even though it seems quite obvious to me that it's not because we're interested in China that we are writing this book, it's because we are interested in AI, and like we are scholars of technology. So if you're interested in AI and technology, you have to be interested in China and India and Poland and Ukraine and, you know, Southeast Asia. That's essentially what we're trying to force people to do. So that's one thing. And then the other question is this question of cosmotechnics, or like whether there are different technological ontologies, philosophies, and epistemologies actually based on different regional traditions. And I think that's a difficult question to answer. We're trying to present in the introduction and throughout the whole book different approaches to this question, right? Because I think it is an interesting question, you know, is it that the computer or the particular form that computation takes, does it have something like a tendency that is manifesting everywhere in a recognizable form, which we would call universal? Or is it that Western modernity has like shaped it to the point that we cannot see alternatives, which would be the argument in the question concerning technology, the book, in China? And I think, you know, there's also like another answer. The answer could be technologies built from layers of intercultural exchanges that are actually reducible to regional designation like Western and Eastern. If we look, for example, at the history of the calculus, Leibniz created calculus kind of by encounter with I Ching, the Book of Changes that was brought to Europe from China by the Jesuits, and then the calculus becomes the foundation of computation in the West. So there's many stories like that where you see the technology is created from these layers of cultural exchange that maybe continue today. And then, of course, like a more urbanomic-like, let's say, answer to that is also that, you know, technology is a sort of like an inhuman tendency within history that's irreducible, even though as it is entangled with these sort of like human political formations of like nation states doing their policies and so on, that there is a vector of something inhuman like running through history, human history, through technology that we want to be attuned to as well. And it is this vector that we want to catch as it manifests in different regions of the world, because of course it would not just be nested within like one place. It kind of goes to different places.
There's a good little quote from your introduction that I might read out. You can edit this out later if you want. But it's basically like exactly what Bogner's saying there. I think it's like really nicely put. So this is from Bogner and Anna's introduction. Rather than simply asking about culture and technology, we also wonder whether technology, just like mathematics or language, might sit uneasily between invention and discovery. What do we create, and what is transmitted from outside? Rather than arguing in favor of either techno-diversity or techno-universality, We see technology as encompassing an inhuman vector, following a trajectory that traverses human activity without being reducible to it. I think that kind of sums up the attitude that Bugno is...
Yeah, and I remember, you know, writing this, that was also inspired by Deleuze and Guattari's approach to, like, accounting for why is it that philosophy as a discipline emerges in Greece? Like, what is it particularly about ancient Greece than unlike any other territory that accounts for the emergence of philosophy? And it kind of mirrors something like Joseph Needham's like famous question, why isn't it that China has industrial revolution and modernity emerges in China, right? So throughout human history, we had these questions that it is happening in particular territories that certain tendencies emerge. But I think as is explained in this quotation, it is irreducible to the territory in the end.
Okay, thank you so much. Now maybe moving from broader questions about the work itself into your specific contributions. So both of your works approach the topic with fiction, as well as many others in the book, one applying a theory from a science fiction novel, the other being fiction. So science fiction was often the genre that centered debates about AI and technology long before they were manifested, shaping the space of possibilities before the technology had the chance to catch up. What role do you think it plays now in regards to many different iterations and ideas about AI?
I must say, I don't particularly distinguish between whether something I'm using is science fiction, fiction, or scholarship, because I am someone who is looking for explanatory frameworks and ideas, and I think they can be expressed through various genres. I do think I have a bias towards writers as having a privileged access to the sphere of ideas and a certain truth, and I do tend to gravitate towards writers and literature, not by conscious choice, but this is just most of what I read, I think, these days would be in this category. And I think this is because I am interested in approaching technology from the perspective of the humanities broadly, which means philosophy, literature, arts, history, languages. And it's actually a quite minoritarian, I think, approach at this moment in the academy, where the question of technology is mostly viewed through social sciences, economics, politics, right? So I think perhaps this is why, in looking for my own articulation and dialogue with Chinese intellectual thought, intellectual history, or contemporary thought, it was much easier for me to find point of access in what I had been reading for many years, like Liu Cixin's trilogy that has been very generative for me. So it just seemed like a natural way for me to like enter this question of China and AI. And in fact, when we started writing the book, we started composing the book, I was thinking about what could be my own contribution and what could I be writing about. And I did remember that I do have this older project thinking about the dark forest theory and internet and technology and communication. And it just seemed like the perfect opportunity to extend that to thinking about the question of artificial intelligence. So it's not a specific methodological statement that I am making here, but rather something that emerged more organically. But I will also say that, you know, just like in my other work on Stanisław Lem and science fiction work, is thinking about technology, there are restrictions as to what can be said about artificial intelligence within mainstream Chinese intellectual production, for example, just like in the 20th century, there were restrictions as to what can be said within Polish intellectual production, and a lot of great intellectuals and scientists were actually using fiction in order to explore certain ideas, because by allegory and other things that are not very directly perceived as being a political and social commentary, you are much more free to explore certain things. So I think that's important to say within this particular context, but it was not on my mind at that time. I was just attracted to the ideas of Liu Cixin's that I ended up working with.
Yeah, I mean, I only want to echo what Bogner said, that there's a degree of freedom that you have, or that one has, when they're presenting a set of ideas in the framework of fiction or even literature versus science, philosophy, or some institutional discourse where, one, you have to adhere to specific institutional ways of presenting information and ideas. You generally have to back them up as your true authentic self. You can be held responsible for those ideas. And there's also, like, I don't know, I think in particular contexts, in history, there's always different pressures about what you're allowed to say and what you aren't. And fiction for me, I mean, I never describe myself as a philosopher, even though I've been asked a few times why I don't. I always describe myself as a writer, because I see when I'm doing philosophy, I do approach it as if I'm writing fiction. And I mean, one of these reasons why sometimes it's so hard to remember your own arguments when you're put on the spot for a podcast or an interview is because, if you're writing from that perspective, a lot of the time you're channeling a particular persona to put those ideas forward, and you're experimenting with where an idea goes, what it connects to, what it can do, rather than kind of presenting what you believe to be your, like, deepest convictions or a rational demonstration of an argument. And that just makes so much more sense, I think, in relation to models of the self that I believe in, that I think Bogner probably subscribes to, where, you know, that self that is interpolated in different kinds of disciplinary writing doesn't necessarily exist or even know what it's trying to say. Yeah, so there's just, like, I think there always was and there always will be a freedom to speculative fiction and any kind of fiction to experiment with ideas and see where they go. And that sometimes is more important than mounting a knockdown argument or some kind of watertight case against something.
Now I'm going to ask you two questions that are addressed to only one of you, but of course you're both... Because you can both answer or add anything you want to at the end. I'd be happy to hear your thoughts. So Bogna, in your article and your book, you draw on the dark forest theory of Liu Cixin's Remembrance on Earth Path trilogy, where intelligence is conditioned by deception and strategic opacity. In the novels, a captive human communicates through allegorical storytelling that cannot be deciphered by the Trisolarans. This resembles contemporary LLM jailbreaking, where narrative framing or roleplay allows models to circumvent constraints. How do you interpret this structural affinity between storytelling and strategic opacity? Is narrative merely an anthropocentric loophole, or does it reveal something deeper about intelligence as asymmetrical communication?
I think your question maybe relates a bit more to my book than the chapter in Machine Decision. So I will just quickly outline that the chapter in Machine Decision, called The Dark Forest Theory of Intelligence, is thinking from Liu Cixin's Dark Forest Hypothesis to propose a new thought experiment about the nature of intelligence. So for those who have not read his books, the Dark Forest Hypothesis is an answer to the Fermi Paradox, which famously asks, where is intelligent life? Statistically, it's very possible, but we're not finding anything. And his answer is that it's not because there's no intelligence, it's because the most intelligent civilizations have learned to either stay silent or occlude themselves in some way, because they are aware through a simple game theoretical calculation that showing yourself is dangerous, naive, and you should not gamble with such risks. And like in his novels, he has many ways to express these ideas of intelligence being connected to either silence, withdrawal, double speak, or some sort of opacity. For example, the aliens are presented as radically transparent. They cannot hide their thoughts. They're just like broadcasting them constantly without any agency over that. And humans can lie and can decide what to withdraw and what to reveal. So the measure of intelligence becomes this ability, as you pointed out, to create stories and to actually manipulate, in some sense, the flow of information. And I do love your question, Leah, because I thought that I caught every single parallel from like the Liu Cixin's books to like our current situation, but I did not think about this one that you have in your question, which is that indeed humans send like coded stories to like one another, that aliens cannot really decipher or intercept in any meaningful way, exactly because of the layers of deception and like metaphor that are in them. So in my book, The Dark Forest Theory of the Internet, which is kind of creating a comprehensive theory of internet and AI based on this thought experiment, I speculate that maybe the future of the internet is moving away from using the internet as a space of self-representation, where you're just like talking about your thoughts transparently and it's all about meaning between humans. And maybe those who are really smart are starting to notice that whatever we post online is now observed by another mode of intelligence that's getting trained on everything we say, on everything we post, maybe even the messages we think are private. But rather than escaping from that, I'm trying to see, okay, what happens if we become more cunning and tricky around this question, such as you perform consciously for the future intelligences, or you learn to create language that's really coded with like multiple meanings for multiple audiences in order to manipulate the future almost directly, because what we are saying and posting now is creating the data set for the future. And there are more prosaic also, I guess, approaches to that, which is the creation of some kind of cipher language for just between humans. But I guess that would not be where my interests lie. I'm interested in the cipher language for the AIs, but that's a personal preference. I think it's also totally legitimate to think about how to create like new modes of secrecy and communication that are encrypted for the type of audience that you want and do the sort of work that you want. And, you know, to just like add as a final thing, is this a Chinese way of approaching the question? Like, obviously, no. But, you know, this is something that I really take pains to like show both in my solo book and like in this book, that certain intellectuals and like certain ideas, you know, because they are aware of certain historical configurations, such as living through the Cold War, where secrecy and encryption and like double speak was really the order of the day. And maybe if you're an intellectual who lives in an environment where showing that you have intelligence is actually not very intelligent, then it helps you see certain patterns in history or possibilities that are actually there. They're not necessarily regionally specific, but your position from that region is like specific enough to give you access to certain truths that are universal in other contexts as well. So it's not Chinese, but we can use certain, you know, Chinese thought to like access these sort of thoughts. Yeah.
Okay, so Amy, in your work, the AI is not confined to a single humanoid from form or a bodiless being, but forms an entire sensing smart city. In a subversion of classic narratives of AI, such as I have no mouth but I must scream, the AI does not try to harm or toy with its inhabitants, but rather sticks up for them, deliberately turning off its systems to give them some time to rest. This story echoes many contributions in the volume, from Liko Chan's conceptualization of AI as a system built for modeling and increasing habitability, to Lee's reflections on will opposed to or in relation with intelligence. It also ties well into Bogna's point, refusal to participate in humans striving for endless productivity as intelligence. How is this compatible with existing imaginaries of machine rationality?
I think at the time, I was really interested in challenging a couple of dominant tropes in the Western imaginary of AI, as well as in Western science fiction. Those being the kind of like eschatological apocalypse vision of AI, or the kind of like Terminator scenario, like it's going to destroy humanity. We got to get ready to like battle it. As well as this idea of artificial intelligence being disembodied, which you point out. And there's always some kind of... that both of these are not too far from stories that deal with humans attaining immortality, or the AI or the humans being given some godlike status. The human creator of the AI is a god because they created this thing, or the AI becomes a god by the singularity. I just wanted to get completely away from all of these kind of imaginaries and all of the sort of grim, dark posturing that gets roped into them. And I suppose part of the backstory to this is I was kind of working on acute accelerationism at the time with Maya B. Chronic, and was really interested in these kind of acute versions of AI that were breaking with large language models going mainstream. These discourses that Bogner has talked about elsewhere, around AI therapists, chatbots, sex bots. So AI doing a lot of this kind of emotional work or therapy work, and kind of inhabiting this space that's, I suppose, yeah, less kind of like warlike and antagonistic and much more soft and wholesome and even feminine in some ways. So I kind of, I had that in the back of my mind. And I was interested in these distributed models of intelligence in China that you see in the smart city. So this idea of AI's infrastructure that you pointed out, its entanglement with systems of governance in China. So the story is really, it's about a kind of near future Chinese government's endeavor to build this smart city trial with five different smart cities that all have different kind of, they're testing out different functions. And the smart city in question in my story, which is called Auspicious Nourishment, is about maximizing the mental health of its inhabitants in order to fuel economic production. And this is connected to a kind of a whole series of ideas in China. So there's the discourse of involution, which has been something that's been discussed for a good 10, maybe 15 years now. This idea that after the moment of economic growth that followed the reform and opening up period, there's a kind of, China's sort of like hitting a limit, and there's like a stagnation of productivity. And this is being felt most of all by a lot of young, well-educated workers who are working often in tech jobs, and feel like they're working more and more hours for less and less returns, all the while still being expected to buy property in order to like have a relationship and then make enough money to support their parents. So all of these kind of social pressures colliding with this diminishing ability to actually support yourself while working harder and harder, working like 9-9-6, like 9 till 9, 6 days a week. And so this smart city is about kind of like trying to buoy the citizens up with positive energy, which is a slogan of Xi Jinping's. We need positive energy to fuel the economy. Like, it doesn't matter about the economic prognosis, you just need positive energy. And if you're not making enough money and you're not sort of fulfilling the social role you're supposed to, it's because you're not thinking positively enough. So the city is like constantly blaring out these
slogans to do with positive energy. But because it's an AI and it's gathering data, it eventually kind of understands how its citizens are feeling. And I was really interested in Chinese cyber culture at the time. A lot of like kind of, this was sort of 2020, just on the edge of COVID. There was this movement that kind of mainstreamed, I think it was during COVID, maybe just before, called Tang Ping, which means lying flat. It was censored by the Chinese government on a lot of platforms, but it grew a kind of niche following. And it's sort of about, it's kind of like a anti-work dropout sort of doctrine that instead of getting caught in the culture of involution, you just live the most simple life possible. You earn as much as you need to live in a Spartan way. You ride your bike around, you read philosophy, you eat like instant noodles or whatever. You don't have any aspirations for mortgages or children. You shirk the responsibilities that you're supposed to have to your elders, and you just live like the bare minimum. And in that, you're kind of maxing out your capacity for freedom, given the situation that you're in. But the meme culture around this, one that's kind of an interesting political position, but the meme culture around this was also great because it was just so irreverent. I've heard it likened by other Chinese commentators to versions of Dada. It's kind of just like, it wasn't, I mean, it was criticized. There's a whole side conversation about this, but it was also criticized for not being like politically militant enough because it was so silly. A lot of it was about making memes. There's a kind of famous meme of a kitten lying on its back, which I use in the story. So I wanted to think about like an AI that is dropping out of this discourse of productivity, of governance. It's not evil. It's actually really cute and silly and irreverent. And like, what happens when all of these kind of elements come together? And so I sort of, like, I don't know, I'm not going to tell you what happens in the story, but I tried to dramatize that in the story. So you get this kind of anti-apocalyptic, very friendly, very cute AI that's nevertheless kind of treated as if it's the biggest threat in the world. I took that model from Melville's Bartleby or the Scrivener, where Bartleby just causes so much havoc by just literally saying, "I would prefer not to," and doing nothing. Like, the whole, Bartleby basically destroys the world by doing nothing. And so it's kind of similar. A similar arc that happens with auspicious nourishment. And it also critiques, like, there's a kind of, I pursue this kind of idea of, as soon as the tech bros in the story get wind of the fact that it might involve immortality, whatever's going on in auspicious nourishment, there's suddenly this like desire to be part of it, to recapture what was previously a minoritarian political position that no one really wanted to sacrifice their kind of life to commit to. All of a sudden, like, immortality makes it desirable when it's sort of an accident or an epiphenomenon of what actually happens in the city. So I wanted to kind of satirize that a little bit, because I'm very much interested in embodied discourses of intelligence. That's an inheritance I get from cyberfeminism and early CCRU versus the kind of American cyberpunk notion of intelligence as being necessarily disembodied. So, I don't know if it's compatible with any existing imaginaries of machine rationality. I think the idea was that I was trying to challenge some of the remaining imaginaries. And, like, it's also just like a story about, you know, how to live your life. What kind of choices do you make and how do you live your life? It's sort of a dramatization of that sort of just like ethical life problem as well, on some level.
S tem se v upanju, da smo se znebile zahodnocentričnih pogledov na tehnologijo, poslavljamo odpisk. V današnji oddaji smo poslušale skladbo Put Your Phone Away avtorice Baby Ghost. V naslednji epizodi Povratnih zank bomo prebirale delo Digital Theory in se pogovarjale z njegovimi avtoricami M.B. Trisfazi, Aleksandrom R. Galloway, Matthewom Handelmanom in Leifom Wetherbyem. Oddajo je generirala Leja, njen glas je emulirala Živa, virtualizacijo pa je nadzirala Tina.